This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's a full show for you this week on Radio EcoShock. Super scientist Mark Jacobson from Stanford University explains soot causing warming, plus a way to run the world on clean energy by 2030. Mark, you've researched and published on a ton of issues we cover here on Radio EcoShock. In our limited time, let's try to hit some of the main points. I'd like to start off with your detailed knowledge of what's in our atmosphere, including the air we breathe. And then let's get to your plan for a world run entirely by renewable energy by the year 2030. So at last count, you've published over 100 scientific papers in the Journal of Geophysical Research alone. And in just one example, you found 18% of all carbon emissions come from a source most environmentalists hardly ever think about. Tell us about burning biomass. What is that?
Well, there's different types of biomass, but the biomass that we've been looking at is what's called open biomass burning. So that's just forests and savanna and woodland. Savanna, for example, is burned for a ritual, but forests are burned often for permanent deforestation to create grazing land and ranch land and farmland. And when you burn that land, you not only put carbon in the air, but you also put a lot of pollution into the air. And well, if it's not permanent deforestation, then some of that carbon grows back as in the form of new trees or new vegetation, although there's a time lag between burning and regrowth, so you always have some additional carbon in the atmosphere. But regardless, when you do burn, whether it's permanent or non-permanent, you put pollutants into the air, and that causes hundreds of thousands of premature mortalities per year worldwide just from open biomass burning. There's other type of burning, which is biofuel burning. There's solid biofuels such as waste and dung and for home heating and cooking in developing countries primarily. And this is actually even a larger cause of human mortality worldwide because this burning is done inside homes where children are exposed. So worldwide, around 3 to 5 million people die prematurely just from indoor burning, air pollution from indoor burning of biomass for biofuels for heating and cooking. And then there's outdoor air pollution as well that causes another 1 million to 2 million deaths per year. Worldwide, total, there are about anywhere from 3 to 7 million premature deaths per year from air pollution from all these sources, open biomass burning, biofuel burning, and fossil fuel burning.
I was under the impression that the amount of sun blocked by biomass soot, known as global dimming, made this a cooling force rather than causing global warming. What did we miss?
Well, so particles in the air from pollution particles, they can cause either warming or cooling. If they're dark particles, such as what's called brown carbon or black carbon, those particles absorb solar radiation or sunlight and then heat up the air around them. And this differs from greenhouse gases, which are transparent to sunlight but absorb infrared radiation from the Earth's surface and trap that radiation below the particles. But it turns out these dark particles cause about a million times more warming per unit mass than greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide do. So they're very effective. But there are other types of particles that are reflective, such as made of sulfate and nitrate and then water that gets associated with those particles, and also ammonium and certain organic carbon as well. And it turns out worldwide of all the particles in the air, about 80% of them are cooling, what I call cooling particles, and the rest are the warming particles or dark particles. And the cooling particles, they offset or mask a lot of the warming that's going on. So if you look worldwide at the total, all the causes of global warming, well, global warming today, it's been about 0.8 to 0.9 degrees Celsius or Kelvin. And that's really due to warming by greenhouse gases and fossil fuel soot and biofuel soot particles, black carbon and brown carbon, that the sum of which exceeds the warming that's observed. And the difference is the cooling particles, which mask warming, almost half the warming of the greenhouse gases plus the dark particles. Now, biomass, when you burn it, it produces both dark particles and cooling particles. And even though there are more cooling particles emitted even by biomass burning, the dark particles are actually more effective at warming than we previously thought. The reason is because not only do they warm the air directly, but they get inside of clouds. And when they get in clouds, they burn off the clouds. And then also when they deposit onto snow and sea ice, they darken the snow and sea ice and melt them faster. So when you actually account for those particles and the fact that when you burn biomass, you're actually heating the air directly just from the burning, that when you account for those effects were not accounted for before. Previous studies of biomass burning just looked at mostly cooling particles and their impacts without looking at the warming particles or their impacts on clouds or snow. And so they concluded that the biomass burning was causing a net cooling of climate in the short term, but a warming of the climate in the long term due to the greenhouse gases. But the more recent study that we did looked at the impacts of both the cooling particles and the warming particles and the impacts of the warming particles on clouds and snow and sea ice, as well as the heating of the air and the direct heat released by the burning, and found that there's actually, even in the short term, you get a net warming of climate due to biomass burning the whole thing.
Mark, some of us have concerns that if something shuts down the industrial system and low-level pollution sources clear up, in a few weeks the world could experience a burst of heating that was masked by that smog. Is that a legitimate concern, do you think?
Well, technically that would happen, yes. If you cleaned up all the particles in the air worldwide, the warming and cooling particles, you would have a burst of heating because of this reduction of the masking that's occurring. However, from a practical point of view, you're not going to be able to shut down all the pollution worldwide, particularly in developing countries. But we do have that goal of doing that. But see, so the solution then is to not only eliminate all the particles, but you have to eliminate all the greenhouse gases as well simultaneously. And even doing that, you might get a short-term burst of a small amount of heating, but within a few years, everything would start cooling more rapidly. And so you can actually come back to the situation you really want, which is a stable climate.
And your paper talks about Arctic ice. If the pollution is coming from the industrial zones of Asia, North America, and Europe, how does it get to the Arctic, and how serious is the impact there?
Well, pollution particles have a lifetime on the order of a week to a few weeks. And so over the course of a week, particles can actually travel around the globe, and they're removed primarily by rain. And so even though winds travel primarily from west to east, they do meander north and south as well. So you do get some transport of pollution to the north, especially pollutants that are emitted in northern latitudes, such as Canada and Europe. A lot of those pollutants in Russia, those pollutants are the ones that get to the Arctic primarily. But even pollutants emitted at the latitudes of the United States and even further south, just due to the circulation system, can get to the Arctic. Now, greenhouse gases, on the other hand, are much longer lived, and they become well mixed globally just because they last for years.
Have you seen the photographs of black in Greenland taken by Dr. Jason Box for the Dark Snow Project?
Yes, I've seen photographs of really dark snow in Greenland. Yeah, it's pretty incredible.
Well, Mark Zett Jacobson, you are one of the experts in the real content of the air we breathe, and I've just read about a new study showing pregnant women should stay away from traffic to have better odds of good lungs in their children. How big is the health impact of running this civilization on fossil fuels?
Well, it's serious. I mean, traffic is a very serious problem in terms of intake of pollution. Not all pollution is the same. More people are exposed to traffic pollution, for example, than power plant pollution because you're just so close to the sources in traffic. And the main problems with traffic exhaust are diesel particles coming out of trucks and buses. But even regular cars, even though they're more efficient and emit a lot less, they still produce some particles, and they produce gases that turn into particles over time. So it's pretty dangerous. In the United States, all air pollution from both traffic and power plants and every other fossil fuel source causes the premature death of about 60 to 65,000 people per year. And this costs the U.S. about $500 billion per year, around a little over 3% of its GDP. Now, worldwide, air pollution mortalities are much larger. There are about 3 to 7 million people per year die prematurely, and a lot of them are from indoor burning of biofuels for heating and cooking. And about 20% of the deaths are children under the age of 5 years old worldwide.
And I've had reports that, you know, of teachers where 20% of the kids can hold up their asthma inhalers in a class in New York City. So when it comes to clearing up the air for public health and to reduce global warming, where are the low-hanging fruits? Where can we affordably and quickly act to make a difference?
Well, there's things that individuals can do, and there are also policy mechanisms that can be put in place to really enhance a large-scale conversion of the whole energy infrastructure. So individuals can certainly be more efficient in their appliances. They buy light bulbs, getting an electric car, which uses one-fifth the energy to drive than a gasoline or diesel car. Heat pumps, using heat pumps instead of gas for heating. Same thing for water heating. You can use heat pump water heaters instead of gas water heaters. Weather stripping your home, being more efficient in terms of transportation, ride sharing. So there are a lot of things that individuals can do. But at the policy level, we really need a large scale conversion of the energy infrastructure. And so that requires policies to incentivize clean renewable energy, such as wind and solar power and geothermal power, hydroelectric to the extent it exists, but to try to improve its efficiency. And tidal wave power are the electric power sources, but also then in transportation, going to electric vehicles, to some extent hydrogen fuel cell vehicles, for heating and cooling, as I mentioned, heat pumps and some electric resistance heating, and then for industry, going to electricity also in terms of heating, for either resistance heating or hydrogen. So everything in the end would be run on electricity, which would reduce power demand in the United States by about 30% just due to the efficiency of electricity over combustion, and without even changing our habits. But then we can get another anywhere from 5 to 25% reduction of power demand by energy efficiency measures. But in order to get this change, we really need policymakers to incentivize the growth of clean electric power generation, as well as clean transportation, heating, cooling.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with a scientist and director of the Atmosphere and Energy Program at Stanford University, Mark Jacobson. Mark, I can hardly mention solar or wind power on this program without getting a few emails warning about all the fossil fuels required to make solar panels or wind machines. Do we really gain energy and save emissions with these technologies?
Yes, definitely. With regard to wind, a wind turbine can run for about 30 years, and it takes about 4 months, maybe 6 months in low wind locations of running to actually generate the energy it needs to produce the turbine itself, to build the turbine itself. So it's basically about 98 to 99% carbon free. If you assume that that energy for that 6 months really came from fossil fuels, 4 to 6 months. But even over time, as we replace the energy infrastructure, less and less of that energy that's used to create the turbine will be from fossil fuels. For example, already in the United States, about 12.5 to 13% of all electric power generation is already clean. So, you know, we've already eliminated 13% of those emissions for building a turbine. And as we penetrate more wind and solar, let's say we get up to 50%, then only half the generation of a wind turbine, production of a wind turbine, will be from fossils. Now, with solar, it's more energy intensive to build the solar PV. If it's photovoltaics, it can take up to 1 year instead of 4 months to 6 months, 1 year in the high solar locations and longer if it's kind of a weak solar location, to regenerate the power that it needed to produce the solar panels. But for concentrated solar power, it's actually closer to wind, because the materials needed are just concrete and steel, basically, and sand for mirrors. So it's not very energy intensive.
You had a great article in Scientific American in 2009 called A Path to Sustainable Energy by 2030, and you mentioned a couple of hurdles to getting there, and the first was a possible shortage of relatively rare elements required for production. Just tell us briefly about that.
Yeah, well, we examined whether there was a limitation in terms of materials for any of the technologies we were looking at, including, primarily, for example, wind turbines or solar photovoltaics or even lithium for batteries for electric vehicles. And so, for example, wind turbine permanent magnets require an element neodymium. But it turns out that if we wanted to power half the entire world with wind, we'd need about 4 million large wind turbines, and that would only take up about 1/7 of the neodymium supply that's known already worldwide, and there might be lots of other supply that we haven't even found yet. So that was not a limitation. In terms of solar photovoltaics, there are some elements for some types of photovoltaics that are limiting, at least based on known resources, but there are so many different types of photovoltaics. If there is a limitation, we can always just use a different type of photovoltaic. And for lithium, there's enough known resources. I mean, right now there are about 800 million vehicles in the world, and there are enough known resources of lithium for over 2 or 2.5 billion vehicles. And so there's really no limitation at this point for lithium. And if there is shortages, you just have a recycling system. Well, we should do recycling anyway. That would really control the waste of lithium.
Well, the second big barrier you mentioned was social, especially finding the political will. We have to tell all the oil and coal workers their jobs are obsolete. The richest people in the world, like the Koch brothers, have to give up their fossil-fueled wealth. It would be a real tragedy, Mark, if we had the technology to make a livable climate but couldn't make that change socially.
Yeah, well, in terms of jobs, so we did a calculation if we converted the entire United States energy infrastructure state by state to wind, water, and solar for all sectors. We had calculated that over the U.S., we would create about 5 million 40-year construction jobs and 2.5 million 40-year operation jobs, and we'd lose about 4 million fossil fuel plus nuclear jobs. So there's a net gain over 40 years of 2.5 million jobs. So it's, in some cases, it would require retraining, but it would actually be a net benefit in terms of jobs. In terms of the money, like the Koch brothers, you know, they've gotten their investments already, so they can certainly take their investments and just shift them without losing any money. There's a lot of sunk infrastructure, and so certainly we should be cognizant of that, and we don't want communities to be destroyed. So that's why there's job retraining would be required. It comes down to the social issue is such that it's people who have a vested interest in the current infrastructure are going to fight it the most. And this is unfortunate, but usually it's the fears that these people bring up of losses are, they're not societal losses. Society will gain as a whole for sure, especially in terms of reduced air pollution, mortalities and its effects, reduced global warming. You'll stabilize the energy prices as well because the fuel cost of wind and solar and hydroelectric and geothermal are zero, whereas fossil fuels are finite and rising prices over time. So you expect to keep the cost down from wind, water, solar. In fact, you can see that in data right now. The 10 states in the U.S. with the highest fraction of their electricity from wind in the last 5 years, the cost of electricity in those states declined 0.4%. All the other states increased their price of electricity 8%, and those are ones relying on fossil fuels primarily. So you stabilize the prices, and you create jobs, and you eliminate warming, and you eliminate air pollution and mortality. So there's really very little downside of doing this conversion. It's something that will create a sustainable energy infrastructure for our future.
And what about the loss of birds and bats to the wind turbines and the 90,000 solar plants?
Every wind turbine you put up decreases bird kills by a factor of 10. The reason is because natural gas and coal kill 10 times more birds per kilowatt hour than wind does. And they kill the birds through not only air pollution, but also through the land degradation during mining and the habitat destruction, but also the buildings that birds crash into. And so there's a factor of 10 higher bird deaths due to gas and coal than wind. And so every time you displace a gas plant or coal plant with a wind farm, then you reduce bird kills by a factor of 10. And birds in the United States, the American Bird Conservancy and the Fish and Wildlife Service estimate up to 440 to 500,000 birds are killed each year by wind turbines. Now, it sounds like a lot. But they also estimate that communication towers kill 10 to 50 million birds per year. Cats are about 80 million birds per year, and buildings are about 1 billion birds per year. So there are a lot of infrastructure that's causing a lot more damage than wind turbines ever will.
Mark, what research are you doing these days as we start to wrap up here?
We do both atmospheric science research. So we look at the impacts of pollutants on climate and human health, and we're developing energy plans for states and countries. So we've developed energy plans for all 50 U.S. states, and you can, in fact, go to a website called well, it's just 100.org, the number 100.org, or also the solutionsproject.org. It's the same thing. So this is a group that is taking our energy plans and trying to educate the public about them and policymakers. So you can go to that website and click on any state, and you can see an energy plan pops up for a state. So we're now expanding that to look at all countries of the world to develop potential clean energy plans for every country, and then working with people to educate the public about it and policymakers as well.
Hope is a dirty word these days, but you're giving me some. I appreciate it. We've been talking with Mark Zed Jacobson, a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University and director of Stanford's Atmosphere and Energy Program. He's the author of 4 books and over 100 papers on pollution and clean energy solutions. Find links to the topics and papers we've discussed in my weekly Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info. Mark, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
All right. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.